Tested is sponsored by Duke Health, home of the Pandemic Response Network, helping communities stay safe and connected during the COVID-19 pandemic by partnering with local schools, businesses, and faith-based organizations to launch COVID-19 symptom support programs in their own communities. Learn more at pandemicresponsenetwork.org.
I'm Dave DeWitt. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, COVID's toll on small towns. When the pandemic arrived on our shores last spring, it showed up in our cities: New Orleans, Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York. But the progression into places with smaller populations has been more gradual, more insidious. And with the dropping temperature, cases are climbing in those rural communities. Towns where getting tested and treated is more challenging. Most of the people getting COVID-19 in rural towns are under 50 years old and are getting infected by interacting with others. At a few dozen here and there, the numbers of cases can be objectively lower than in a city. But those numbers fill up a rural hospital quickly, and losing any one person can have an outsized impact on a small town. My colleague, WUNC reporter Jay Price, recently went to Spindale in western North Carolina. While he was there, he met up with a woman named Sophia Hamilton and talked to her about her husband, James.
He was a town commissioner and a deacon at his church. He coached youth basketball and football. And his wife, Sophia, says he still somehow found time to mow the grass at the church and for elderly friends and neighbors. She jokes that sometimes it seemed like they had him more than she did.
But I know that was his heart and that was his calling, so I just had to get over it.
But they don't have him now, and she doesn't either. Hamilton died last month at age 55 after contracting COVID-19. His wife said he likely caught it while, as usual, looking out for others. He visited a neighbor who was dying of cancer, then got a call. The neighbor's son, who had been present during the visit, had tested positive. His wife said Hamilton immediately got tested, but the results were a false negative.
And then, you know, when everything started going downhill, they went on and took a rapid COVID test and found out he had double pneumonia and he did have COVID.
Community transmission of the virus has reached alarming levels in parts of rural North Carolina. In November, state health officials found rural counties were reporting nearly twice as many new cases as urban and suburban ones. Rural deaths tied to COVID-19 have also been climbing significantly.
Jay reports that community transmission of the virus has reached alarming levels in parts of rural North Carolina. In November, state health officials found rural counties were reporting nearly twice as many new cases as urban and suburban ones. Rural deaths tied to COVID-19 also have been climbing significantly. More reporting from Jay Price on how COVID is rampaging through North Carolina's rural communities is at WUNC.org. Jay said James Hamilton was a black man and that Latino and black populations continue to suffer disproportionately high consequences from the pandemic. But the state is now saying the infection rate is shifting and now increasing among white residents in these rural areas. Either way, these communities are losing people fast and leaving grief in their places. As we listen to Sophia Hamilton express her grief, we have to ask ourselves, was this inevitable, that COVID would migrate from urban areas into small towns?
Yeah, I think it was.
That's Mark Holmes. He's director of the Sheps Center for Health Services Research at UNC Chapel Hill.
If you compare sort of the resources and environment of rural and urban areas, you know, urban's usually a little more dense, well, is more dense, but rural has a lot of disadvantages in other ways, and everything from the ability to work from home and get food delivery to a population profile that's generally more susceptible, older, more co-occurring conditions, comorbidities, and then of course the weaker healthcare infrastructure that we see in rural health as well. So yeah, I think from the very beginning, most people expected, urbans to take the first hit as the transportation hubs saw, international airports and the like, but then eventually would spread to rural and take hold.
Are there any particular areas that you see now as getting really bad or potentially being bad? Specifically, I know it looks like Nash County's had a real rough go the last couple of months. Wilson, other areas of eastern North Carolina. Do you see it getting better or worse there? And do you see other hotspots popping up?
I think probably the takeaway from the last 10 months is that we see an explosion in one community, and that's hot for a while, and then it kind of tapers, but then something else pops up a county or two away. Sampson, Duplin, Bladen, that's into Wayne, that's been a particularly hot spot for a while. I think lately it's been in the Columbus-Robinson area, down in the Sand Hills, kind of over to the coast. So there's always an area to be looking at. It does change, but it usually is. It's tended to stay away from the Dare County and Currituck Craven. The far northeast has generally had some of the lower rates.
A series of explosions, outbreaks that turn one county after another into a hotspot in our state. Leanne Wisnett has been a witness to that ebb and flow. She's the health director in Alexander County, just north of Hickory. Transmission levels there are among the highest in the state, with nearly 17% of those tested in recent days found to have COVID-19.
You know, when you're standing right beside somebody for 8 hours a day, it's hard to keep your guard up for that entire period. And we've also seen COVID fatigue. People are just tired. And so I think we kind of let our guard down. Our numbers had been low, and so people that were asymptomatic or not very sick didn't realize that was what was going on and maybe was at an event. There's challenges because we are such a small workforce. So for public health, that is very taxing after you've already had 6 or 8 months of extra work, because we have not stopped the other work. We just added COVID extra work on top of everything else we do. And, we're not meaning to sound like I'm complaining, but at some point you get really tired.
Who can blame folks for wanting to let their guard down?
Healthcare professionals have been, I'll say, on the go to various degrees of complete, 80-hour work weeks, depending on the current surge, and they're tired.
That's Mark Holmes again from the Shep Center.
If you look at rural hospitals and you have one respiratory therapist and they get sick or a family member gets sick, that's it. They're really limited in what they can do. So there's not a lot of margin from the beginning. And then when you bring in a stressor like this, it really exposes the fragility of the healthcare system and most notably the people who are behind it. And I think we often lose that aspect of it, is that every bed needs nurses and physicians and, allied health to support it. And we don't have a good sense of what the state of that resource is. And that's going to run out before the beds and the ventilators are, most likely.
Obviously, in the last, probably more than a decade or so, we've seen rural hospitals close or merge with other health systems. How has that played into sort of how people can now get treated for COVID? And is it better or worse now if you get sick in rural areas?
Well, I think there's a couple of aspects to that question, Dave, which is a great question. So since 2010, there have been just over 130 rural hospitals closed across the country. They are predominantly located in the South. And in North Carolina, depending on how you count, it's probably about 10 in the past 15 years that have closed. And particularly when we see rural hospitals close, so that's a resource that's immediately removed from the treatment infrastructure. You see that pretty quickly. No place to be admitted, no ICU, no ventilator. But beyond that, the more fundamental question of what a rural hospital adds to a community, it's everything from the clinic infrastructure and the clinics that are associated with that hospital. So you're not just losing the inpatient bed, you're losing the ED, you're losing the doctors and nurses who are taking care of you, and sometimes you're losing the ambulance and the home health and all that other ancillary services that we don't think about, everything else that comes with it. Beyond that, as rural hospitals close, we know that there are economic impacts to the community. And one thing we know about closures across the country is that they are more common in economically challenged communities, particularly because of demographics and, you know, large manufacturing plant closing, for example. So what you're seeing is these susceptible, economically, you know, struggling communities lose the hospital, and you're piling on a county or a community that's already challenged. You remove that healthcare and it makes it that much worse.
A lot of those places you're describing, I grew up in and lived in until my 30s. Small farming communities, my case, Ohio, not here in North Carolina, but you see a lot of similarities, obviously. And among many people, there's that kind of don't tread on me quality, that sort of rugged individualism, if you will, that exists in towns like that. For people who are farther away from urban areas, they're used to, you know, relying on themselves to fix cars and do things like that because they can't easily get to places that, can do that. And is there something in your research or some data point where you've seen that, where you say, oh, that really is that sort of mentality of folks who live in these areas?
So we know that from surveys, mask wearing is less common in rural communities. I don't think we really know what's behind that. And some of that may be, you know, libertarianism, rugged individualism, whatever ism you want to use to describe that. But I think there's also a lot we can point to in the sense of case counts. And I've had conversations with multiple people, particularly rural residents or people who spend a lot of time there, who say, oh, in County X, there's only 200 cases. In Wake County, there's 1,000 cases. Wake has it worse. And I have to keep saying, yes, but if there's only 2,000 people in County X, and I've lost track of my numbers, but, you know, from a per capita standpoint, you know, what's the probability that the cashier in front of me at the grocery store has COVID? And the better sense of that is not how many cases are in the county, but what percent of people have it. And I think that's been an understanding that hasn't really fully translated.
So what now? Mark said even with a vaccine on the horizon, North Carolina communities aren't likely to see notable relief soon. Stay with us, more after the break.
There are things we're taught not to discuss in polite company, but by avoiding so-called impolite conversations, we're missing out on the chance to make important connections with each other. I'm Anita Rao, and I'm on a personal journey to uncover just what happens when we open ourselves up to talking about taboo topics that affect our bodies and our brains. Find out on Embodied, a new podcast about sex, relationships, and your health from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
As we were putting the finishing touches on today's episode, Governor Roy Cooper was holding his weekly COVID briefing. When we first started this podcast back in the spring, we often included the governor's updates as we were all just learning to come to grips with living in a pandemic. As tested evolved and we moved toward contextualizing various aspects of what we're all living through, we included the governor's comments less frequently. To be honest, I kind of got numb to the updates. But today seemed different. For one, it's historic. In Britain, people started getting the COVID vaccine. 91-year-old Martin Kenyon was one of the first, and he told CNN about it.
I didn't think I feel about it at all, except that I hope I aren't not going to have the bloody bug now. I don't intend to have it because I've got granddaughters and I want to live a long time to enjoy their lives.
The vaccine is an amazing scientific accomplishment, of course, and something to be celebrated. But a few hours later, Governor Cooper gave an update that was decidedly less upbeat.
We've seen rapid increases in our key metrics here in North Carolina. Our case counts have broken single-day records on three separate days in just the last week, and the percent of tests returning positive has increased to more than 10%. A month ago, we were deeply concerned to see daily case counts go above 3,000. Now we're shocked that the number has doubled, with some daily counts at more than 6,000.
Cooper pointed out what experts have said almost since the beginning. The winter months are going to be dreadful.
Hospitals across the state will be stressed to capacity and maybe beyond. And if you're one of the unlucky ones, your family may suffer the terrible loss of losing a life if you haven't already. Dr. Mandy Cohen is the secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, and she did her best today to try to prepare us for what lies ahead.
I'm very worried. This is a global pandemic. This virus is highly contagious and dangerous, but we can slow it down. Do not wait until it is you or your loved one who is sick with COVID to wear a mask, wait 6 feet apart, and wash your hands often. Do not wait until it's you or your loved one alone in a hospital bed struggling against this virus. Do not wait until it's your family that loses someone to COVID-19. Act now.
The other day in the grocery store, I came across two men standing in the self-checkout line not wearing masks. Yeah. It had been a while since I saw someone maskless inside a store, a place we all need to go in some manner. It was infuriating, but like all emotions during these past few months, it quickly morphed into exasperation and sadness, and finally, numbness. It's a coping strategy, of course, but one we have to resist. If we don't feel the loss or understand the severity, the pandemic will be worse and go on longer. So we all need to not get numb to the awful numbers and graphs, the terrible stories of people dying alone or losing their businesses, or even to the weekly updates from the governor.
When this pandemic came to North Carolina in March, I know many people didn't expect to be living this way in December. This year has been tiring and frustrating and painful. With the holidays here, many of us feel it more deeply. But the stakes are dire. This is truly a matter of life and death.
That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Dave DeWitt. Our producers are Rebecca Martinez and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Special thanks to Jay Price. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.